last Friday when I gave a talk here, after the talk was finished and everybody left, I went to the airport to go to Thailand and just came back this afternoon. I sandwiched my trips between these Friday night talks. But the trip over to Thailand was as part of the Waisak ceremonies. The Waisak is the one day of the year in May, the full moon night of May, which happens to be tonight. If you look up in the sky, you'll see the full moon. And that it marks the birth, enlightenment, final passing away of the Buddha. It's a huge ceremony throughout the world. And being a popular monk, I get invited and have to go to many places to celebrate many Waisaks. And part of the ceremonies, there was a huge ceremony in Bangkok every year. Last year it was in Hanoi, but this year in Bangkok. It was a United Nations sponsored Waisak ceremony, an international one. So I was over there representing Australia, and it was very inspiring to not just have ceremonies with many of the most senior and powerful monks and Buddhist scholars and nuns, but also to have the opportunity to use these great Buddhist teachings to solve some of the bigger problems of the world. So we talked about how we can use Buddhism not just to help a human being achieve more peace in their life, not just in the individual level, which sometimes we think that Buddhism is just about the individual, how you can be happier, more peaceful, more free, but also to make use of these Buddhist teachings in a more international arena. So we did talk about things like the global economic crisis. And those of you who think that these conferences now have no effect, as soon as we finished our three-day conference, the share market rose throughout the world. Look, the evidence is out there. It worked. We talked about the political crisis in the world. And look, the last few days, Thailand has been peaceful again. So maybe we should take responsibility for these things. But one thing which we did discuss, which is going to be the topic of this talk tonight, is that not only in the individual theatre, but also in the national theatres of our world, how much we underestimate the power of goodness. It's not hard power, it's not soft power. It's a power of ethics and virtue and goodness, which has a huge effect on this planet. And everybody keeps on saying the reason for the current economic crisis, which is about to heal, is because of our conference, of course. The reason why it's about to heal for good is reason the problem was there, because of excess greed. We're not looking at the proper things in life. I mean, how much money do people need to be happy and well? If you want to know how much money a person needs to be really happy, go and look at me or the monk sitting next to me. We've got absolutely nothing, and we're very happy. And it's a great symbol, like a monk or a nun. So what is a monk or what is a nun? One of the most important parts of them is one with few possessions. And we live like that. Now, at these conferences, people give you all sorts of stuff, all sorts of gifts. There's Prime Minister of Thailand, Deputy Prime Minister, this great person, that great. They give you all these sorts of gifts. But what do you do as a monk when you receive all these things? You say, thank you very much, and give it to somebody else. So I never brought any of that stuff home with me. Because my home in my heart is peaceful and free. And I don't want it cluttered up. In the same way that when you get a gift, what a wonderful thing it is. Somebody gives you a gift. Oh, it's very kind of you. They get a lot of happiness when they give you something. So what do you do next? You give it to someone else. And they get a lot of happiness. And they give it to someone else. Please don't store possessions. Just pass it around like passing the parcel. And eventually it will get to somebody who really needs it and appreciates it, and then they can keep it. But what a wonderful thing it is not to keep things, but to be part of not what is a static, but this process, this dynamic act of giving and receiving and enjoying the gifts and enjoying the process of giving and then passing it to someone else and passing it to someone else and passing it to someone else. So one gift keeps going round and round and round, making many, many people happy. And eventually, and it's happened to me, then the gift I gave someone, they say, "We've got a present for you, Ajahn Brahm." And it's the gift I gave someone else about 3 weeks ago. It's happened. See, it's the law of karma. What goes around comes around, literally. But we all know that sort of, well, it's the greed thing, is this: you get a gift, you want to keep it. You have money, you think it's yours. You know, you have a house, you don't share it. And what are things for anyway? They are for sharing, for enjoying, not just by yourself. It's not very nice enjoying things by yourself. In fact, it's almost impossible to enjoy it by yourself. But sharing it is a wonderful thing to do. You get much more happiness that way. As they say in business, you get far more bang for your bucks when you share your bucks. So we all know that greed is a problem. Well, why are people so just greedy? And why are people, just like in politics, we also talked about the political problems in the world, why are people just so angry? And what's the point of getting angry at somebody? Does that help at all? And look, come on. Every time you've got angry, what has been the consequences? Has it ever solved the problem? When you've been shouting, upset and angry, you may shout at someone for 2 or 3 minutes, and the echoes of that shouting and that anger, they stay with you all night. And you think about it, you have no peace, you're upset about it. It really screws up your brain. And no wonder many people have tumours. That's no joke. Angry people. Sometimes I give a simile. You know, the camera's on. I'll take my robe. I haven't got many sort of, I don't have PowerPoints, but at least I use whatever resources I have. A robe, this robe, you see how loose I wear it? Actually, this was one of the similes of differences between a Buddhism and some other religions, which somebody pointed out at a talk which I gave to a group of executives, a little club of executives in Netherlands, a few years ago. It's a wonderful comment. This exec came up to me afterwards and said, "Not just what you were talking about, but just the way you talked, you know, it really impressed me." And I found this wonderful simile, she said, because I was brought up in a Catholic convent, and there were nuns there as well. But those nuns, their clothing was just so tight. Everything, you know, was just very clean, which was very smooth, there's no creases in their wimples or whatever, and everything was just held so tight to their body. You, Ajahn Brahm, your robe is falling off, it's all loose all over the place. And he said, "That's Buddhism, compared just loose and easygoing." And I added, "Yes, when it's loose like this, it lasts much longer, because it hasn't got so much stress on it. Because if I hold my robe and pull it like this, how long is it going to last? That stress is going to wear out the fibers, and eventually the whole thing is going to tear and wear out. So if you're an angry person, you've got this tension in your brain. If you're an anxious person who is fearful, and it's just fearful of the future, you're almost like angry at the future. And you tend to actually wear out your brain and the rest of your body as well. What do people do that for? So all that anger, it kills you, and it also just creates all these problems in the world. Now, one of the reasons why people get angry is this stupid idea of revenge. They've got no right to do that to me. They've hurt me. They've been cruel to me. They really messed me about, and I'm going to show them. And of course, revenge has nothing to do with any type of spirituality. Only stupid people seek revenge. I'm being quite blunt. If someone's hurt you, and you feel that you have the need to hurt them back, which is what revenge is, to make them pay, to punish them, you haven't really understood how to make a peaceful world or how to make peace in yourself. You have to let it go. So there's too much like revenge, there's too much like hatred, there's too much of this greed business. And it's because of that that people aren't good. And one of the points which I was making in my presentation, and it was echoed in so many other Buddhist presentations, the power of goodness. To not only have a good, sustainable economy, but to have a world which is going to be here when you get reincarnated into it in your next life. The way these climate change is happening, the only place you can get reincarnated is a fish, because we'll all be underwater. But also just to have some political sort of peace in our world, some harmony. Sometimes you talk to politicians. You know, you meet them, and even actually make this announcement. There's a few of the Thai people here. The Thai foreign minister's in town, and he's coming to our Wesak on Sunday at 10 o'clock. That's your foreign minister. You wonder, busy foreign minister, why is he coming to a temple for? Why did a Thai prime minister, a deputy prime minister, turn up for a Wesak celebration, you know, in our conference? Why do they do this? It's because these politicians, they realize that something is just not working in their system. And one of the things which is lacking is exploiting not the economic power of a nation, not the material resources underground, but the goodness resources of humanity. And there's one thing which I've noticed in my life. I have a really interesting life as a monk. You know, you meet famous criminals. And I'm not talking about politicians now, I mean, I'm talking in jail. But I have met these guys. I have shaken hands with such people like John Howard and Thaksin and all these other people. We've also shaken hands with, perhaps the most notorious person I've shaken hands with, Ronnie Cray. You know, he was one of those Cray twins, these terrible gangsters in East London. You've met these sort of people. I mean, how many other sort of careers can you actually have breakfast with the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka and then go and meet this notorious criminal in the prison for the mentally insane in, what is it called, in somewhere in England? Broadmoor, that's right, Broadmoor jail. It's a great career as a monk. I really recommend it. It's the most interesting life at all. Anyone think you're just going to get bored out of your skull meditating all day? It doesn't actually happen like that. But you can go that path if you want to. But in all those times, I've never seen a person who I can't respect. It's a weird thing. You're seeing some of these rapists and child molesters and terrible people, so people say. There's always something inside them you can respect, which is one reason why you don't feel the necessity for revenge. The power of goodness is something which is generated through the power of wisdom. And wisdom is not what you learn at school. It's not what you get out of a book. The wisdom is opening your heart and your mind to see what you're not expecting to see. And that's what happens when you meet a murderer. You don't expect to see any goodness there. At least that's what I was taught. You know, these are evil people. These are cruel people. I should have, I kind of bought it because I just haven't gone back to my monastery yet. But when I was asked in Bangkok a couple of nights ago, how can you forgive some of these people who've done terrible, terrible, terrible things? And I said, I used to carry around a poem. I used to carry this around in my bag to use on occasions when I was asked such a question. And I'd take out that poem and read it. It was an apt time to talk about this poem because Sunday is Mother's Day, as well as Vaisak Day celebration here. Because this was a poem about a son's duty to his mother. And I can't remember totally the poem, but I always remember part of it which just really moved me very deeply. It was said, if your mother asks you for something, always listen to her and get it for her. And if she asks you again, go and do it again for her, with joy, not with resentment. And if she asks a third time, please go and do it, no, without being annoyed, because the day will come when your mother can ask you no more, when she's gone. So no matter how many times she asks, go and help and give. That was part of the poem. But the best part of the poem was the last line. The last line, the author, it was Adolf Hitler. The most beautiful poem written by a person who's supposed to be the most evil, awful person in the Western world anyway. And the reason I love that poem was, it wasn't perhaps the best poetry, but it was good poetry and it was moving. And it was written by a person who has been demonized. If Adolf Hitler could love his mother and express that gratitude so beautifully, isn't he worthy of forgiveness? Isn't your wife, your husband, whoever else has annoyed you today, aren't they worthy of forgiveness? To let go of the revenge in our hearts. And when there's no reason for revenge, when we can respect the other person, when we can understand them, where will be the anger? A lot of anger comes from not seeing the full picture, from not understanding the truth of the matter. That's why we get angry. You've seen it many, many times in your life. You can get angry not understanding what the other person is doing and why they're doing it. And all of the causes, all of the effects, all of the complex interwoven forces in our world. We just don't see the whole picture. We see a tiny bit. We think that person should not have done that. And sometimes we do that to ourselves. That weakens goodness. How many wars have been started because of the need for revenge? Wars of anger. But if for some purpose, some reason, we can gain that wisdom to forgive, it increases our morality, our goodness, our ethical strength. We will strengthen and empower this thing we call goodness in our world. We become higher people. And the power of goodness is immense. We all know how Gandhi got rid of my forebears, the British, out of India. It's an amazing story. Just with this power of morality, he did take the higher moral ground. He claimed that higher moral ground. And the British, because I know the British, I'm one of them, they think of themselves as a civilized people. That's why they say, it's not cricket, they say, to be mean and to cheat people. You've got to do the right thing, to be a gentleman. All that sort of British stuff, there was actually something to be admired in that attitude. It took morality as an important part of their culture, even if they didn't practice it. This was respected, and it gave that country a lot of power, a power to influence, to so-called civilize, and to take people up to a high level. But as soon as that empire lost its goodness, it lost its influence and its power to do anything good in this world. Many empires have started off, some empires, not all, some have started off in violence, but some have started out preaching a morality, a goodness, which has actually taken people, inspired them and moved them. Even the history of communism, it started off as noting some of the terrible injustices to the poor people of basically only Europe at that time. It inspired people because it had an ethical message. It was only impossible to practice, and it was abused by the tyrants of those dictatorships in Europe. But nevertheless, it was the ethics, the goodness, or the apparent goodness, which made that a powerful movement in this world. The power of goodness is something which will overcome, we discussed in this conference last week. It will overcome one of the other pressing problems in the international theatre, that of fundamentalist, extremist terrorism. I do read the newspapers. I do talk to people, and people who have much more information than I have. And you can understand how people think. You do visit Islamic countries. You don't just talk to the Buddhists. You talk to imams as well. You can understand where a person's coming from. You know, one of the most attractive parts of Islamic fundamentalism is the people who join think that they're doing something wonderfully good for the world. They do really feel that they are doing good and creating a more ethical world. As many people have noted, if our Western world could have a higher ethic, in other words, not be seen as so selfish, as so greedy, and so easily given to anger, then many commentators have said, and this is a powerful point, the power of goodness would overcome the need for people to take up arms and fight. I think that extremism is on the wane. It is being undermined, not through war, but through things like forgiveness, through things like having high ethical standards. For times when, say, there is a disaster and people send so much money, give so much time and energy and effort to those places in the world which have been destroyed by earthquakes, fires, diseases or other disasters. That undermines terrorism because it shows a higher goodness. And just as you will be attracted to something which creates better harmony, peace, prosperity and freedom in the world, so others would also be attracted to a higher ethical level and standard of behavior. The power of goodness is huge. People vote in politicians and parties not just because they're going to lower your taxes. Sometimes you vote them in because they're going to end corruption, at least so they promise. So they're going to do away with unethical behavior, pork barreling, looking after their own interests, creating wars. We vote people out. Barack Obama was elected with such a large majority on the platform of a higher ethic, of goodness, of kindness, of trying to heal the wounds in the world, of being more outgoing, reaching out a hand of friendship rather than a fist of violence. That was why people got inspired. He was harnessing the power of goodness. It is a power in the economic sphere, in the political sphere, in the sphere of extremism. It's a power which has been noted and seen, and I think you're with me here, you know it's a power. It is a way out of many problems which face our world and the future of your children and your next rebirth. Not other religions don't say that. It's not just your children you're worried about. You have to worry about it. But why is it that that power of goodness is not being harnessed? Why is it the ethical standard sometimes does go down? And this is the problem. Everybody knows. Too much greed. Yeah, but I'm greedy. Too much anger. Yeah, but down with these people who sort of, you know, kill my friends. People are selfish. Why? How can we let go of that and go beyond that? And one of the great things of the Buddhist teachings is it gives you practical methods to actually to overcome those causes which stop people being good. The things which do hinder some of the growth of kindness and peace in this world. Simple things like being aware of what you're saying and what you're doing. And how it feels. And sometimes, why do people get angry? Sometimes it's a question which was really bugging me for many years. Because I knew that I'd seen anger just create so much problems in the world. I remember just one of the last protests. I was a socially aware person before I became a Buddhist monk. I remember one of the last protests which I went on. We were facing the police, just in this park outside of London. And the police were being violent. And I was ready to stand there and take it with my friends. Until I was next to another friend and saw his eyes go red with rage and pick up a bottle and throw it at the police. When I saw that anger, I was ashamed. I was ashamed and so disappointed that the protest had been fatally wounded by one act of violence. I never protested after that, but I always thought, why did that fellow get so angry and so mad? One of the reasons was he was totally unaware of what he was doing. He was out of control. There's one thing about the practice of meditation. It makes you more aware of a wider sphere. It's not just that policeman over there, whatever he's doing or whatever he's standing for. Because when you get angry, you're only focused on the object of your anger. For him, it was that policeman. You're not focused on what's going on inside of you, how it feels, what it's doing to your mind. And certainly, you're not focusing on this amazing thing, the space between you and that policeman. The training in Buddhism is a training to widen your mindfulness, not just focusing it on the object we call the bastard, that terrible person, that awful thing out there. You're not just focusing on that, you're focusing on what's happening inside of you as well. And that little bit of changing of your focus is one of the great solutions to the problem. If you know how it feels when you get angry, feels inside of yourself, what you're doing to yourself, your body, your mind, you never get angry. It simply is not worth it for you. It's killing you. There's an old Buddhist story. An old Buddhist story of this woman who had a problem with anger. So she went up to her favorite monk and said, "Can you please help me? I just always get angry. I don't want to get angry. I'm supposed to be a good Buddhist, but I get angry at my husband, I get angry at my mother, I get angry at my children, at my work, because I'm always getting so angry. Help me, or else." So the monk took one look at her. And she was in very nice clothing, a lot of makeup, and a lot of these bangles which make so much noise. I call them handcuffs, but people call them, you know, bracelets. But anyway, he saw she was a vain woman. So he asked her, "Have you got a mirror, madam?" "Of course I have." "Every time you get angry, take the mirror out of your handbag and hold it in front of your nose and see what you look like." "Is that all I need to do?" "Yes." According to the story, next time she got angry, she remembered what to do. Put up the mirror in front of her. She was so surprised at how ugly she looked when she got angry. It was a monster in that mirror. Not the normal thing which she saw when she did her makeup or brushed her teeth. It was this monster. And because of that, according to the story, she never got angry again. So if you've got a person who's got angry, if they won't take out the mirror, you get a mirror and just show it to them what they look like when they get angry. According to Buddhism, if you get angry many, many times in your next life, you'll be born as ugly. Let alone your next life, in this life you get ugly. It's true. Who likes to look at an angry person? I like to run away if I see an angry person. They look just so frightening and so ugly and so repulsive when they're angry. So be careful. Those of you who get angry and shout a lot, in your next life you'll be very, very ugly, and no amount of makeup and makeovers and wigs will help you. But of course, when I heard that story, I think that just won't work. It doesn't matter, you know, if I put a mirror up in front of somebody who's angry, she just punched the mirror and then me next. But there was something more to that story. And the more to that story is, it's not just a physical mirror made of glass with silver on the back. It's the mirror of self-awareness. What that story really meant was the monk was teaching her, next time you get angry, hold a mirror up to your heart. Feel what it's like when you're really upset and angry. When you're really upset at somebody. When you really disagree with them. Because they're saying something which you don't agree with. What's it like when someone says you're wrong? What does it feel like inside? When you actually start feeling your body and your mind, you'll find it so easy to overcome that anger, to overcome that resentment, to overcome guilt, lust, everything. When you understand what it feels like, it burns. It's very, very unpleasant. And you know that it's something which is so unwholesome, it will cause sicknesses, it will kill you eventually. It's a disease. Swine flu. Because you are the swine. It kills you. Just coming back from Bangkok into Singapore yesterday, I gave a talk and the plane was a bit late because I had to be in a meeting beforehand. And so as soon as the plane landed, I started to walk very fast to get out quickly, to get in the car and go and give the talk. People were waiting for me, a couple of thousand. But then I decided I better stop walking so fast. Because even in Perth Airport, especially Singapore Airport, they've got the heat cameras focused on you. And if I realized, I thought, you got it. If I keep walking fast, I'll get my metabolism up, build up a temperature. And they think I've got flu, it's just I've been exercising too much. So I quickly slowed down, cooled down, I jumped up, otherwise I would have got through. I just thought of that in time, I'd been in big trouble. But you can actually, when you feel what this is doing to you, it is burning you. And swine flu is nowhere near as dangerous. There's no the anger, the resentment, the guilt, the anxiety, which are in people all that time. It does make you hot. You can actually feel it. And it kills you. And even when we're trying, there's one fellow just gave a wonderful presentation of when we're actually settling things, when we're discussing. We're trying to have some peace development between warring parties and people such as the Palestinian leaders and the Israeli leaders. How can you get a compromise? How can you get sort of a solution to these problems? feel what it's like inside of you when you're just facing this person who's responsible for imprisoning your people in poverty, taking away their land. What does that do to you when you think like that? What does it feel like when you say, I respect you, you're my friend, I can be kind to you? When you feel the change inside of you, what it's like to be kind, to be forgiving, you feel it inside. That is the start for the ending of the argument. You feel just the way to make those solutions. And one of these guys I was saying, who's given this presentation, it's a nice presentation, he works as a mediator, mostly in Southeast Asia, amongst Buddhist people, on how to solve conflicts. Not by thinking and talking. People can talk and talk and talk, and they end up arguing and arguing and arguing, shouting, 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 busting fists, and then leaving the table with no agreement whatsoever. But to feel what it's like inside. Understand those emotions which colour and bend your speech, which create the distrust and the resentment and fear and anger, which perpetuates the disputes, which causes so much pain and suffering, untold pain and suffering throughout our world. If only we can actually get a bit of meditative awareness, then there will be agreement. Because those emotional blockages, the barriers which are far tougher than any Berlin Wall or any wall separating the Palestinians and the Israeli state, will be breached. It's a wall inside of ourselves. The wall of emotional stubbornness. If you can feel that, you can let it go. And it's amazing how you can find a solution if you have the right state of mind, both of you. All arguments, all things which separate human beings, even in your family, even in the law courts, even in your offices. Why do people have these arguments? We feel terrible about it afterwards. These are people I respect, this is my wife, I love her. Why did I argue with her again? The reason is because you're not being aware of what's happening inside of you. You're not understanding how it feels. And when you realize just how painful it feels just before you argue, just before you say something terrible to the judge, just before you do something awful to the people you work with, when you feel what is about to happen, you just can't do it anymore. It's just too painful. And instead, you can be kind. And that kindness, that softness, that peace is incredibly powerful. It's the power of goodness. Anyone who thinks that's weakness just doesn't understand their history, doesn't understand the way this world works. Goodness is the power. You don't get far with violence, with anger. Yeah, you can shout somebody down. You can actually shout them out of your office. You can actually beat them down with the stare in your eyes. Temporarily. You're just covering up the problem. But with kindness, with peace, with understanding, there's something there which can connect you with somebody. All the conflicts, whether it's in a marriage, whether it's an office, or between countries, it's all relationship problems. That's why I quoted this former Thai Prime Minister, Sanya Thammasat. He would come up to Ajahn Chah's monasteries, and I remember he came up to our Wat Nanachat once, and even though I was only second monk at the time, still very small in years as a monk, he did come and talk to me. And he told me something which I'd always remembered. He remembered this was a prime minister, you know, the head politician, The guy was running the country, a big country, with many problems. He said there was never any problem he could not solve by going to his adversary in politics, going alone. And he said he'd put his hand on that man's knee. You can't do that in Australia, that means you're gay. In Thailand, it means you're a friend. You know, the way things people do it in Asia and Australia, they're different, so you've got to be very careful. I don't mean this advice to be done in exactly the same way here in Australia, you get into trouble. But if you go up to your adversary and do an act of kindness, of friendship, he said, in Thailand, I got to my adversary, put my hand on his knee, and that was expressing that, look, I'm a friend. And we discuss it, and we could always find a solution when we found that solution together. Because problems are never the problem of the other side. It's never your problem. It's always our problem. In a marriage, if it's on the rocks, it's never your wife's problem. It's never the husband's problem. Please remember this. This will save many marriages. It's always our problem. So don't go blaming him. Don't go saying to your friends it's her fault. It's our fault. It always is our fault. It always is our problem. Never their problem, never my problem. If it's their problem, you get anger. If it's my problem, we get guilt. Both are completely stupid, unnecessary emotions which block solutions. When it's our problem, we are sharing, finding ways to work together to solve what is hurting both of us. It is always our problem, isn't it? When we have anger, ill will, fear, anxiety, that puts a barrier between me and you. When we have the compassion that pushes aside that barrier, we are seeing, feeding off each other. That's where we find our solutions. So peacemaking in our world, finding solutions to climate change, whether it's emissions trading schemes, whether it's daylight saving or no daylight saving. What's a stupid thing about arguing about something as stupid as that? Have a compromise. Put the clocks back half an hour. I don't think that will get very far. But you can see just how people take up positions. And they can argue vehemently over the most stupid of things. Why? And how can we stop that? Feel it, what it's like when you get into such arguments. I just don't want to do that anymore. If you have that mirror of mindfulness, of self-awareness, whenever you get angry, upset, it won't last that long. You get out of that habit. Which is why we should teach more of our politicians, business leaders, husbands and wives, parents, how to meditate, how to be aware of what their terrible emotions are doing to them, and what it's like to have peace in your heart, and how that can free the barriers between you and the other. And once those barriers are taken down, solutions are easy. We can find solutions when we work at it together, when it is our problem. So the power of goodness, this is just one example. It inspires, it encourages, it makes people want to follow those leaders when they're good and kind. And this is just an aside. A long time ago, I read, and I like to read and understand how history works. And I was reading about politics in ancient Rome. And I found out why a politician, even today, is called a candidate. The reason is because the word candid is a Latin word for white. In ancient Rome, anyone standing for the Senate, which was the political body which ran that empire, anyone standing for the Senate would wear white clothes as a symbol of his purity, of past conduct. He would be elected. I don't think there was any women being elected then. But he was elected not because of what he promised to do in the future, if elected. Not because of some manifesto, which you all know is not worth the paper it's written on. It's usually written on toilet paper as far as I'm concerned. Broken promises. It's not this party or that party. Everybody does that. Because how can you make promises? You don't know what's going to happen next in the world. But why is it you demand, or the media demands, to ask the politicians what they're going to do? Any honest politician would say, I don't know. See what happens. And then make a nice decision next. But in ancient Rome, they were not elected on what they were promising to do for you or the country in the future. They were elected on the basis of their past conduct, of what type of person they had been in the past. And that's why they wear white, as a symbol of purity. We even have that these days. See, people who come to the temple keep 8 precepts, you wear white. Even people, devout Muslims, wear white. Even people getting married, the bride always wears white. Why does she wear white at a marriage? A symbol of her purity. Why does the groom, the boy, always wears black? Figure it out for yourself. So you can see just simple things like this actually help us have a better world. There was Buddhists, and anyone who listens to this on the internet, next time is an election. Forget about what that man or woman are promising to do for you in the future. Don't even listen or take that into account. Instead, look at their past conduct, where they have been honest, been kind, been wise, been compassionate. And elect such leaders. Because it's not what they promise for an uncertain future. I don't blame any politician for breaking promises. I blame them for making those promises in the first place. Not for breaking them. That's just totally unwise. But then if you have a compassionate, wise, moral person, and they've shown that by past conduct, elect them. You'll be far better able to have a good government, and therefore good problem-solving, good leadership for the future. So little things like this, which our little conference started putting out. It's not just thinking that a group of monks and nuns and scholars in Bangkok can actually solve the world themselves. But the thing is, these are leaders who go out and give talks like this and actually change people's way of doing things. When we change the way people think, and you see, this is actually quite positive. This is not some theory, this is something you can actually do and change and do something better for this world and for your marriage and for your own life. Be mindful of how you feel when you do things or say something. It will soon change the way you act. Be wise in your responsibilities. In the office, the family home, or whatever you lead. And who knows, maybe we can make a better world. A world of greater goodness. The power of goodness is immense. If we want to save the world, it's not some technological innovation which is going to save us. It's not some wonderful person who's going to appear at the right moment. Some super Barack Obama, even better, a Buddhist black African president. But no, that's not the way out. The way out is each one of us having a higher morality, a higher goodness, taking a stand simple things. Filling in your tax return honestly, accurately, 100%. Not lying. Telling the truth. Not taking alcohol. Keeping precepts. Being totally faithful to your partner. 100%. Even though you may be attracted to someone else. No, I'm not going to go and do that. Even though I'd like to, I want to, I'm yearning to. No. Stop. Every time I increase the level of virtue in my life, I always felt the power. When I gave up alcohol, I felt power, strength, inner strength. You know, when I gave up, not stealing, but I'd go on the public transport in London, and I think, if that bus conductor never asked me, I didn't need to pay the fare. It was his responsibility. And then I decided that didn't feel right. Someone has to pay for that petrol in the bus and that conductor's fare. So even if they didn't ask me, I'd actually go and pay them. And sometimes it's wonderful when, you know, you say, excuse me, I haven't paid you yet, here you go. And they look at you and think, wow, this is amazing, this is weird. Somebody is honest. And that really shook me. Why is it that people are so surprised of honesty? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we lived in an honest community? A community which never cheated? Forget about other people. You, as if you're Buddhist, or if there's any Christians here, you're a Christian, be honest, for goodness sake. A Muslim, a Sikh, a Jain, a Hindu, a non-believer, whatever. Can't you believe in goodness? And rise above just the easy way and put some energy and effort and inspiration of increasing the power of goodness in your life. You find it is a power which can change things. Not just your life, not just your health, but your relationships at work. And most importantly, in these trying times, now, when there's always this news, if it's not swine flu, it's the economic crisis, I don't know what's coming next. But I'm sure there'll be something. Some war, some terrorist attack. Can't we actually rise and use the power of goodness to stop things in this world, which are causing so much pain and misery? The message of our conference, it can be done. It is a power. It is something which other religions, other races, other ethnic groups, every human being, every animal recognizes. Even as I was telling people at Bangkok, every time I travel in Muslim countries like Indonesia or Malaysia, I'm respected. Even though I'm a Buddhist. And the reason I'm respected is people know a Buddhist monk has a very high level of virtue. We are good. We do keep high levels of honesty and precepts and simplicity. And that respect gives us the power. You take that power as well. You be good, ethical, and your respect will increase. And you'll be free from danger, because people don't want to harm ethical people and good people. Last story, which I haven't told for many years. I read this when I was a monk in Thailand, from an American journal. In New York, there was an Indian monk. And I must have got lost one evening, he was walking back, and was bailed up by some hooligans, some street kids, who got out a knife and pointed it at this Hindu saint. Hand over your money. He said, I don't have money. Don't give us that. Hand it over. He said, look, I'm a Hindu holy man. Come to give some talks. I don't carry any money. I don't have any possessions. We don't believe you. Have a look. I don't know exactly how the conversation went, but after 2 or 3 minutes, these hoodlums were so pacified that they listened to him talk about ethics, and in the end they said, "I'm sorry, sir, we've made a mistake. Please go away peacefully." And it was reported in the newspapers, and the newspaper journalist said the most amazing thing was these people called anyone sir. The power of goodness meant this guy was completely invulnerable to some of these kids who would slit your throat for $10. That's the power of goodness. It protects you and it protects the world. The power of goodness. Go for it. And thank you for listening. Okay, anyone got any questions about tonight's talk? All the problems in the world, easy to solve. You've got to be much better people then. Yeah. Okay, you're asking the question, if I want to do something good but I don't really want to do it, so there is a bit of a problem there. And I could be nice or I could be honest. I got a choice. Hang on there. If being nice is being dishonest, that's not good. It's not good lying. So being nice doesn't mean being good. Because sometimes you do have to give what we call, you've heard me say this before, performance assessment to your husband, to your kids. And how you're honest to them is not just shouting out, "You stupid kid, you know, you sort of haven't been doing your homework. You know, you bad husband, you know, you haven't been doing your jobs around the house. Bad wife, you haven't been good enough to me, you haven't been giving me enough sex," or whatever else you say when you're married. That's not how you sort of treat people. Sandwich method. This is. I said this over in Thailand again. They asked me, where is it in the suttas? In the Vinaya. It's not exactly called the sandwich method, but it's a way you admonish fellow monks. Praise them, first of all. And then tell them what they've done wrong. And then you praise them again afterwards. Sandwich. Sandwich your criticism between two acts of positive affirmation to that person. That's being good.
I think that I should take some out for dinner or something from you, but I don't want to.
Okay, you're saying sometimes you feel you should take someone out for dinner, but you don't want to. But do you really know what you want? Because you feel I want to take them out for dinner, but I don't really want to. Sometimes when I have like a conflict like that, I'm not trying to find out what I really want to do. I have like priorities. What's the most important thing? And it's not just enjoying the dinner, but it's not actually getting the food which I want. The more important thing is there's the higher goal of having happiness and friendship with somebody. So even if it's taking them to a restaurant which I don't like, it's more important that I turn them on and have a beautiful relationship with them. So sure, there's part of it I don't want, but the higher level of priorities is what I want. And that's what goodness is. Putting this great ethics as the most important thing. Even if it's going to cost you money and cost you other things. Yeah, I'm very poor, I don't really want to spend my money, but look, what's more important? So remember what's more important in life. That's why that famous saying, somebody reminded me of this in Bangkok. The secret of a happy marriage? Secret of a happy marriage? If you're wrong, admit it. If you're right, shut up.